With Notre Dame Federal Credit Union, our online banking and mobile app are like having a branch right at your fingertips with everything you need to use and manage your accounts 24/7. Check us out at NotreDameFCU.com, insured by NCUA.
Welcome to Truth and Charity with Bishop Rhodes. A special thanks goes out to our friends over at Notre Dame Federal Credit Union for underwriting the show. I'm Kyle Hyman here with our good Bishop. Welcome back, Bishop.
Thank you, Kyle. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. You've been back for a little while now, but you've done some traveling. You had the USCCB meeting and then went over to Rome.
Yeah, I've had 2 weeks of the Bishop's meeting was in Orlando. So that was like the third week of June, I guess. No, second week. And then the week after, I was with the National Eucharistic Congress leadership in Rome, and we went to Assisi as well. So it was great.
So let's maybe start with Assisi. What were you doing in Assisi?
Well, part of the itinerary was to go to Assisi and meet with the mother of Blessed Carlo Acutis.
Okay.
Now, she happened to be on vacation, so it ended up being a virtual meeting,
okay,
but it was still good. So we had an overnight, or was it two nights in Assisi, which was beautiful because I had not been back for many years. And yeah, I love Assisi. I used to go there a lot when I was a student in Rome, and I love walking the streets and hiking. And What was different this time, I mean, the city or the town changes a bit. It's interesting. Well, of course, it had the earthquake, so that obviously did a lot of damage. Mm. So, you know, I've seen the restorations, like the upper church of the Basilica of St. Francis. And I had mass at the tomb of St. Francis in the crypt,
Okay. Which
was very special. I had had mass there before, but it had been many years. So I love celebrating mass there. And then I had not been there since Blessed Carlo Acutis was buried there. And it was interesting, one morning, They have his body like with a thin layer of wax over his face in what is the old cathedral, which means, you know, goes back to the time of Francis, over 800 years. And that's where his body is. And it's visible. He's in tennis shoes. And so it was neat. I went there one morning early before, you know, a lot of people came. So I kind of had a good half hour there just praying in front of his body. And that was great. And that's where St. Francis, that's at the spot where the bishop lived back in the time of St. Francis. And that's where the spoliation took place. That's the Italian word. I'm trying to think where he stripped. Remember when his father was opposing him and had even locked him up and everything. And Francis took off his clothes in front of the bishop and said, you know, giving the rich cloth back to his father, and said, and then the bishop quickly covered him with his cape or whatever. And then Francis said, I have one father, the Father in heaven. So that was a key moment in Francis's life where he gave up all these material things and basically gave his life totally to God. And what was really interesting is got to meet the Bishop of Assisi, wonderful man, holy man. And a priest who's working there took us down to some excavations under the bishop's house, because the bishop still lives there, where they found the door, the gate. It's kind of like the portal of the door to the bishop's house where this would have taken place, where Francis would have had that encounter with the bishop and his father. So we saw that. I'd never seen that before because that was never, it's still not open to the public, but they took us down. It will become open to the public. So that church is called St. Mary Major, Santa Maria Maggiore. And the new cathedral is called, which is like 700 years old, it's not that new, is up above in the closer to the main square. And that's called San Rufino. And we were there because one of the members of our group, they had a new baby, just like a month old maybe or less, an infant who was baptized. So we were there for the baptism. And Bishop Cousins, who is the leading bishop of the National Eucharistic Revival, baptized this little baby girl in the same baptismal font that Francis and Claire were baptized in.
What?
Yeah, really amazing.
Wow.
Yeah. And then another part of the time in Assisi that was new for me was we were there on June 22nd. And that's the day when they celebrate St. Clair, when the Saracens, the barbarians, were invading Assisi, there's the famous story of they were going to destroy the town. And when they were getting up to the gates, St. Clair brought out the Blessed Sacrament. And they turned away. Huh. So that was the day, June 22nd. So every year they have a procession from the Cathedral of St. Rufino down to San Damiano, is where the poor Clares lived, where St. Clair lived, which is like halfway down the mountain. You know, and that's the church where Francis repaired it. Remember where the crucifix spoke to him, you know, rebuild my church. Mm-hmm. And that's where the poor Clares lived. That's where St. Clair lived all those years. And they all lived in Cloister. So at 8:30 p.m., the procession began from the square in front of the cathedral with trumpets. And it was like walking back 800 years. Uh-huh. And they read different accounts, ancient accounts of the Saracen invasion in St. Clair, different spots along the way. We processed, and it was dark all the way down, and it was torches all along the way, all the way down to San Damiano. And when we got there, so there's a lot of people, Bishop Cousins and I, they never usually had other bishops, so the Bishop of Assisi was there, but Bishop Cousins and I were in the procession, vested as bishops. And then he went in to San Damiano and brought out the Blessed Sacrament. Uh-huh. And then there, we had adoration. And it was very moving. I mean, it was hot, especially being in cassock and everything, but it was so beautiful. So, I mean, the whole thing was like 3 hours, you know, 8:30 to probably 11:30. So that was a highlight because I had never experienced that before. And that day and a half or whatever we had in Assisi was a real highlight. And we went from there on our way back to Rome to Orvieto, where the famous Eucharistic miracle, the cathedral there, beautiful, beautiful cathedral. But not far away in the town of Lanciano was the Eucharistic miracle where blood came out from the host onto the cloth, the corporal. And the corporal is a main relic in the Cathedral of Orvieto. So that's kind of a major Corpus Christi site, major Eucharistic shrine. So we were there for a few hours, had mass in the Cathedral of Orvieto. The corporal is only opened, you know, it's in a big reliquary, but they only open the doors on very, very special occasions to see the corporal. So we didn't get to see it, but that's to protect it from sunlight and all that. But just having mass there was really special. And that was important because really our week there was a Eucharistic focus. It was a Eucharistic pilgrimage because we were praying for the success of our National Eucharistic Revival and National Eucharistic Congress. And of course, the main purpose was to meet with Pope Francis, mm-hmm. which we did.
Well, this is amazing because we're supposed to talk about St. Benedict today because this is his feast day is this week, but you're bringing up other things. I think we need to do an episode on St. Francis at some point. I don't think we have for some reason. St. Clair would be another great episode. And Carlo Acutis, Blessed Carlo Acutis. I don't think we've really talked about him on the show. So this, we'll have to come back to those.
And I would love to because I have devotion to Francis Clair and now Carlo.
Yeah.
So I'd be happy to.
Yeah. And I imagine there's a lot of people that don't know much about his story. But you're there with this National Eucharistic Revival going to Rome. What kind of meetings are you having there? What's happening? You met with the Pope.
Yes, the first day, actually. Okay. We arrived on Sunday. And of course, you know, the Pope had surgery. So, you know, we weren't quite sure a few weeks before, you know, is he going to, but they said that he was going to begin his audiences again on Monday, June 19th, which is when we had scheduled the audience. So, but it was, you know, we're of course wondering, you know, his recovery, is he going to be okay? Cause they could push it off. And, but it took place. So it was in the Vatican, in the Apostolic Palace. So that morning we were gathered in one of the beautiful rooms of the Apostolic Palace. I don't know if there's pictures. I don't know photos that are out. And the Holy Father came in walking, using a cane.
Oh, wow.
But he was walking. I thought he'd be in a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. And then he sat down and gave us a talk on the Eucharist. Beautiful. It was short, maybe 5 or 10 minutes.
In Italian?
In Italian. But there was an English copy for the for the participants. So
were you reading the English copy or were you listening to the Italian?
I was just listening to the Italian. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It always happens when I go back. It's really funny because it just takes a few days and the Italian comes back. But when I spoke to the Holy Father, I spoke in Spanish because, you know, it was just, we were only there a day. Uh-huh. And, you know, my Italian would have been, I think there probably were some Italian words because it always gets mixed up in my brain. But
I imagine.
Yeah.
But so your Spanish is stronger than your Italian right now?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. If I'm back there like a week or two, then I'm speaking it again.
Yeah.
But anyhow, after he spoke, they brought him the monstrance, which we had brought over. 4 feet tall monstrance made in Mexico. Beautiful. And it's the monstrance that will be used in Indianapolis at the National Eucharistic Congress.
Okay.
So
probably not for the processions then.
No, okay. No, it'd be too,
yeah,
too big. And the Holy Father blessed it. And then after that, we each were able to go up and greet the Holy Father. Uh-huh. And what was really neat, I was able to get a couple of our guys, priests and seminarians in Rome. Mm-hmm. Some are home, so they weren't there. But the ones who were still in Rome, Father Mark Hellinger and seminarian Patrick Ernst, I was able to bring in with me so that they could also greet the Holy Father.
Yeah.
So that was wonderful. And not only that, Father Paolo, the new pastor at St. John the Baptist in Fort Wayne, was visiting. He was in Rome because he was visiting his parents. He's from Italy. Uh-huh. And his parents came down from Trent, from Northern Italy, along with his sister. So I was able to get Father Paolo in also. So he got to meet Pope Francis.
So anything, big discoveries, big changes in what's going to happen with the Eucharistic Congress after these meetings?
No, I think it was just a strong word of support. The Pope was saying to us, this is really important. You have my blessing. In one part of his talk that hit me was he said, you know, we're losing a sense of the importance of silence and adoration. Mm. Silence and adoration. And we need in our lives to adore the Lord in the Blessed Sacrament. And we need to spend time in silence, in prayer, because, you know, everything is so noisy and all that, that we need to recover that in the church as well as in the world. So that's probably the message that, I mean, I should have brought the talk with me. I could share it, but that was something that really hit me. Mm. And then while we were in Rome, we had masses at different, obviously at the tomb of St. Peter, at the tomb of St. Paul. Hmm. We had mass also with the Missionaries of Charity. That was really special to me. I had not been back there in many, many years. And that's where I would celebrate mass as a young priest, both a mass in Italian for the homeless in a shelter that the sisters run. Mm-hmm. And then I'd also celebrate mass early in the morning for the sisters in English. English is the language of the community of the Missionaries of Charity. That's, mm-hmm. as you know, the community that Mother Teresa founded. But what was neat when we visited, we had mass there with the sisters. And again, like I had done that, I was just, I mean, this was in the mid 80s, so it's a long time since I had mass there. But we got to visit the room where Mother Teresa would stay when she would be in Rome. And I also was in the room where I met with her a number of times. I never saw her bedroom before because she was alive, but got to see that, very simple, of course. And the chapel where I had celebrated mass. And, you know, it was like just bringing back a lot of memories because, like I said, I had not been back there since the mid 80s. So, you know, seeing everything again kind of like helped my memory because I probably wouldn't have a good image of it. But now I do again, because going back kind of, you know, stirred my memory.
Were any sisters still around?
None from when I was there.
Okay. They thought
one, well, there was one elderly sister that we thought may have been, but I didn't remember her. The other sister, the sister that I was closest to was a German sister who I was hoping would be there, but she's the like superior for Europe or something. Yeah. So she was in Germany or somewhere else. No, she was in Poland, they said. but she was the superior general. Huh. She was like not the one right after mother died, I think, but the second or third one after mother died. So she's a friend of mine, but I haven't seen her since the mid 80s. And she knows I'm a bishop and, you know, we have communicated, but I would love to see her sometime. Yeah. So that was neat. And it was very hot. It was like 95 degrees every day. So I didn't bring enough black shirts. I was like, oh my goodness, I'm sweating so much. Yeah, I should have remembered how hot Rome gets in the summer. Uh-huh. But that, it was kind of even hotter than normal.
Well, good. It sounds like it was a great trip. And thanks for sharing a little of that with us. And I think it gives us some fodder for some future episodes as well. We did mention that this week we celebrate the Feast of St. Benedict, which is July 11th, his feast day. So there's a lot that we could talk about with St. Benedict. There's the rule of Benedict, obviously, you know, many writings and things like that we could probably discuss. I actually don't know a whole lot about him.
Yeah, I mean, he was born around the year 480. So it was a time where the Roman Empire was really collapsing. So this was, and it was only, how do we know about Benedict's life? St. Gregory the Great, Pope St. Gregory the Great, wrote kind of a lot about Benedict's life. So that's our main source of information. So Gregory the Great tells us that, you know, some kind of a biography, really. Benedict was from a province called Norcia, and kind of well-to-do family. And his parents sent him to Rome to study. But he was really put off by Rome because at that time there was a lot of immorality, mm-hmm. especially his fellow students. Mm-hmm. So he really didn't want to be part of it. He didn't want to fall into the same sins or mistakes of his classmates. So his big thing, and this is what Gregory the Great said in Latin, soli Deo placere desiderans. In other words, he only wanted to please God. So he didn't finish his studies. He left Rome and he went to live in solitude in an area in the mountains east of Rome. And he lived with a group of monks that were living there, but then he didn't stay long with them. He decided to become a hermit in that area in a place called Subiaco. And this is a very special place. And you know, most people who visit Italy or visit Rome, it's not a stop that they make. But I highly recommend, when there are pilgrimages to Rome, I said, make sure you have a day trip to Subiaco, uh-huh. where Benedict lived as a hermit. And he lived there alone in a cave for 3 years. And they called the place where he lived, this cave, the Holy Grotto, the Sacro Speco, Holy Grotto. It's been called that since the early Middle Ages. And so it was during those 3 years, this time of prayer and solitude, that really Benedict matured. And he was facing kind of some fundamental temptations. You know, in other words, temptations that are very common for everybody, but he wanted to grow in holiness. And so he spent that time kind of to be purified, to grow closer to God. And so the first temptation, of course, is to like pride, to be self-centered, to, you know, there's always that temptation to put ourselves at the center. Pope Benedict wrote about this regarding in a talk he gave on St. Benedict. And another common human temptation is sensuality, okay? Not being able to control our passions, mm-hmm. For things, especially in the sexual area. And third, the temptation of anger and revenge. So those are the three kind of basic temptations to sin. And Benedict felt that if he was going to serve God and help others, he had to basically overcome and conquer these temptations in his life. So those 3 years in Subiaco really were a time of grace for him. And he grew so much in holiness. And it was only after those 3 years that he decided to found the first monasteries. And he did kind of nearby in Subiaco. But then he left Subiaco and he ended up settling in Monte Cassino. Monte Cassino is south of Rome. I'd say maybe 80 or 90 miles. I can't remember. It's high up on a plateau, a much more prominent. Like if you go to Subiaco, you're kind of like in the mountains, but there's, but when you go down to Monte Cassino, you see this is this big mountain. And on the top of it is this huge monastery that was started by Benedict. So at this point, so he leaves this kind of remote area and goes to Monte Cassino to this plateau and founds the monastery there. And it was there that he wrote the rule for monks. That's very famous, the rule of Saint Benedict. And it was there that he died. But that's a very important, well, both places are very important for Benedictines, both Subiaco and Monte Cassino. Monte Cassino, by the way, was bombed during World War II and destroyed. It had to be rebuilt. But interestingly, Benedict's tomb was untouched. And also the tomb of his sister, Saint Scholastica. They were buried in the crypt. So their tombs were not destroyed during the war. But there are cemeteries nearby of those who died and were killed during the bombing. So Gregory the Great is the one, his writings that tell us a lot about Benedict's life, his spirituality. Definitely prayer was at the center. But it was not just prayer. It was also work. In other words, the life of a monk, according to the rule of Saint Benedict, is to serve the Lord with one's whole life, but centered always in the work of God. So that's why monks, for example, pray throughout the day, the whole liturgy of the hours, the divine office. And, but then it's important to live and act, you know, so, and to work. So it's a life of both contemplation and action. So the famous motto of the Benedictines is ora et labora, Latin, which means pray and work, ora et labora, but in everything to give glory to God. So this was Benedict's life, and it had to do also with serving others. Love comes before everything else, Benedict says. Humility is essential. I love Benedict's writing or Benedict's teachings on humility. I'll get to that in a minute. The importance of obedience to the abbot and then the important responsibilities of the abbot. So all of this you can read in his rule. When he would talk about the role of the abbot was to be a loving father to the monks, but he was also to be a strict teacher. So, and when you think about it, it's kind of like good educators, you know, you have to have discipline, but always with love. And that's how Benedict wanted monasteries to be. Of course, this had a huge effect. The Roman Empire was collapsing. Okay. There was a lot going on. So really Europe was in disarray. And Pope Paul VI declared Benedict to be the patron saint of Europe. This was back at the time of the Second Vatican Council, because really monasteries started springing up all throughout Europe and beyond, Benedictine monasteries that kind of became centers of culture, centers of learning. Thousands became monks, followed this rule of Saint Benedict. So you can say that the Christian culture was preserved at the time of the fall of the Roman Empire by the Benedictines. I mean, we could do a whole episode on the whole monastic life and monastic renewal that took place. But it all began, I mean, we call Benedict, Saint Benedict, the father of Western monasticism, the father of Western monasticism. The rule is not very long to read. I mean, it's about, in a small booklet, it's about 90 pages. So it has, the rule has 73 chapters, but the chapters are really brief. So you can read it really in one sitting or two sittings. And it gets into the kinds of monks, the qualities of the abbot. There's a chapter on obedience, another one on restraint of speech. There's several chapters on the different hours of the day as far as the liturgy of the hours and their life of prayer, a lot on their life of prayer, proper amount of food to eat, proper amount of drink, you know, daily manual labor was important. So there's parts of that. And even then getting into concrete things like the election of an abbot and things like that. So you can, and even lay people there, for example, up at, in Mishawaka a few months ago, I met with a group of Benedictine oblates. These are lay people mm-hmm. who, according to the lay state, kind of live the rule of St. Benedict, or at least parts of it. That, and I was really happy that we have this group of Benedictine oblates in our diocese. And they are connected to St. Mindret's, which is a Benedictine archabbey in southern Indiana, okay. southeastern Indiana. And we have two guys going there to this. I'm sending two of our young men to the seminary there in the fall.
Oh, okay.
So the Benedictine spirituality can also be adapted for lay people and even those who become what are called oblates. Oblates kind of, you know, are connected to a monastery. So usually one of the Benedictine monks kind of is a spiritual guide for them. The chapter that I think in the spiritual life that has most impacted me is chapter 7 of the rule on humility. And I recently read a book published by Ignatius Press by Father Augustine Weta. And it is he's a Benedictine, and it's called Humility Rules. Uh-huh. And it's St. Benedict's 12-step guide to genuine self-esteem. So
you say you did read that?
I did. Yeah. And it's really good, but it's like 12. Yeah, like he titles it, it's 12 steps in how to really grow in humility.
My favorite thing about that is the pictures.
Yes.
Did you notice like he yeah. photoshopped all these yeah. old saint pictures and stuff?
Yeah, all these pictures of Benedict.
Yeah.
And others, yeah. Mostly of Benedict.
Like with surfboards and stuff.
Yeah.
Added in.
Yeah, it's really good. So if someone's looking for that, I mean, I recommend this book, Humility Rules, but also, you know, just getting a copy of the Rule of St. Benedict. They have it, like I said, they have it in all different languages. So they have it in English. So we're celebrating his feast. And as I mentioned, his sister is also a saint, St. Scholastica. Her feast day is, I think, February 10th. And of course, Benedict's is July 11th.
So when you say that he is the founder of Western monasticism.
Father of.
Are you saying there was other monasticism, like Eastern
yes.
monasticism, but he popularized it in the West?
That's right, because already in the East, you know, like St. Anthony of the Desert, who's also called St. Anthony the Abbot, he was earlier, that's 3rd century. So there were monks, especially in the East, but even, you know, when Benedict went to Subiaco, there were some monks there, so... But I would say that we really call Benedict the father of Western monasticism because it was more of an Eastern phenomenon, and it was kind of not real organized, kind of scattered in the West. That's why we can call him, as you said, founder or father of Western monasticism. If you say founder, I guess you could say that, but founder would be like he started it. Well, he didn't exactly start it.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So if somebody's interested, one of these two books, Humility Rules or just reading the Rule of St. Benedict booklet, or I'm sure it's online as well. And then if somebody wanted to be an oblate, reach out to St. Meinrad's. Would that be the best?
Yeah. The group up in Mishawaka meets, I think, monthly.
Okay.
At St. Bavo's.
Okay.
But there was an article about the group in Today's Catholic, but I don't know who you would really contact. I guess... yeah, definitely St. Meinrad.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then how did you decide to send two seminarians there when you usually are sending them to the Mount?
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, sometimes I try to look at different, you know, at formation programs. Uh-huh. We've had a few men, you know, we have a few men studying in Rome at the North American College. Mm-hmm. Most of our men are at Mount St. Mary's in Maryland. But then we've had a few guys at Mount St. Mary's in Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. So really we had three, and then Bishop Routé Seminary for those who are still in college. Mm-hmm. But for theology, I've been sending to those three. And the other diocese of Indiana all send to St. Meinrad. So I was talking to the other bishops. They were very positive about the formation. And so not sending to Mount St. Mary's in Cincinnati anymore, because the last one I just ordained, that was Father Ryan Tomosi.
Okay.
You know, it just, I was kind of impressed because, you know, there's a new program of priestly formation that includes a propaedeutic year, kind of a extra year that the Vatican has mandated prior. It's a year before you actually start doing your formal studies.
Yeah.
It's a year more of human and spiritual formation. And that's where I was really impressed when I saw the propaedeutic year program at St. Meinrad. So that's why I'm sending to there, because I want them to get the best formation. You know, I had a conversation with the rector of the seminary on the phone, very impressed, sent the vocation director, Father Andrew went down, uh-huh. the former, because Father Andrew just finished his term. Father Andrew Buzinski is now the pastor at St. Matthew's Cathedral. So the new director of seminarians for the diocese is Father Jonathan Norton. So we'll see how they do at St. Meinrad. I would like to get down and visit. I've only been there once. That was when we had a diocesan pilgrimage down there some years ago. But I also decided to split the position. The vocation director of our diocese, Father Andrew, you know, they always had both jobs, promoting priestly vocations, but also overseeing the seminarians. And a number of dioceses have kind of split those two responsibilities. And since we don't have a full-time vocation director, mm-hmm. I thought, well, I think I'm going to try that. So I split the position. So Father Jonathan at Sacred Heart in Warsaw will be the director of seminarians, and Father Dan Neeser, pastor of St. Dominic's in Bremen, will be the director of vocation promotion.
Oh, okay.
So this just started the changes that were made last month.
Yeah.
And I think that will allow more time to be devoted to promotions mm-hmm. because, you know, these priests are also pastors. So right. It's not like they're doing this full time. So by splitting the responsibilities, I think it'll allow more time for, especially on the promotion side, but also on the oversight of the seminarians. And they're both very, very fine priests, Father Jonathan Norton and Father Dan Neeser.
Sure, yeah. Well, great. Well, thank you for sharing about the life of St. Benedict, your trip to Rome, and all the adventures that you've been on. Could we get your Episcopal blessing before we go?
Yes. The Lord be with you.
And with your spirit.
Blessed be the name of the Lord.
Now and forever.
Our help is in the name of the Lord.
Who made heaven and earth.
May Almighty God bless you, the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Amen. Thank you, Bishop.
You're welcome, Kyle.
Truth and Charity with Bishop Rhodes is brought to you in part by Notre Dame Federal Credit Union. It's engineered by Josh Skipper at the Diocese of Fort Wayne South Bend, produced by Miriam Schmitz, and edited by Tony Marks for Spoke Street Media.
This podcast is part of the Spoke Street Network. For more great podcasts, visit SpokeStreet.com.